This program is brought to you by PersonalLifeMedia.com.
From time immemorial, beginning with indigenous councils and ancient wisdom traditions, through the work of Western visionaries such as Plato, Galileo, and quantum physicist David Bohm, mutually participatory dialogue has been seen as the key to evolving and transforming consciousness, evoking a flow of meaning, a Daya flow of logos, meaning, beyond what any one individual can bring through alone. So join us now, as together with you, the active deep listener, we evoke and engage in living dialogues.
This is Duncan Campbell, your host. I'm delighted to have as my guest here Lynn McTaggart, internationally renowned journalist, author of, among other books, The Field, The Quest for the Secret Force of the Universe. Her groundbreaking book, which brings up to date quantum physics, which was really discovered almost a century ago with the latest cutting edge discoveries in physics, biology, and so on, that do in fact fill in some of the gaps that were there for decades in quantum physics and that actually have very direct impact on our lives. And this is not just a theoretical scientific conversation. This is really about how ordinary people, we who are not scientists, can change our lives, and the scientists can too, in a way that is really very revealing and different than how we were taught in school. So I'd like to welcome to the program Lynn McTaggart.
Hi there. How you doing?
Hey, Lynn. It's a real pleasure to have you on. And for those that don't know you, you've just arrived from the UK, from Britain, where you live, joining us here in this field of energy. And so without further ado, Lynn, there's so many ways to introduce you. Maybe I'll let you pick out the things that you think are most relevant, because you've had a really varied career. You've written several books, including What Doctors Don't Tell Us, one on Kathleen Kennedy, and various other books. And let's ask this question. What caused you to turn your considerable skills and attention to this somewhat seemingly esoteric field of modern physics and biology?
It's a very interesting journey, Duncan. I am the editor of a publication called What Doctors Don't Tell You. We're the largest health newsletter company in the UK. We own this company, and we publish three newsletters. And what our sort of brief is with them is to look at the scientific evidence for medicine and alternative medicine, and we write about what's proven and what isn't proven. So I'm always studying medical literature, and in the course of that, I kept coming up against study after study showing things like homeopathy and spiritual healing work. And it was so amazing. These were good scientific double-blind type trials that I started thinking that something fundamental must be left out of the paradigm that we're given in biology about how we work and in physics about how the universe works. And so it really started me on a quest. And this is really about 8 years ago I started thinking and looking at this. And I traveled to many parts of the globe talking to frontier physicists about their portion of experimental or theoretical evidence. And I stuck with very credible, prestigious type people who worked for, you know, universities like Stanford, Princeton, and the like. And then it was my task really to put it together and try to synthesize this into a new theory.
And so, could you describe for us in brief that theory, and then let's go back and unpack it. We'll go back then to the two or three primary discoveries of quantum physics that may be familiar to some of us: the observation effect, the Heisenberg principle of uncertainty, the principle of non-locality, and so on, that really have changed our view of the world quite radically, but have not even today, almost a century later, really penetrated mainstream culture. And that's why What the Bleep is such an interesting film, because it is getting people educated in the mainstream that really don't know anything about this, and they're flocking to this movie. It's become a sleeper hit all over the country. Sometimes people go back four or five times. They form discussion groups and internet chat rooms about it. And so something is beginning to perk up in the field. And so why don't you tell us what the field is, and then we're going to go back and talk about how it's moved forward and what these exciting, really revolutionary discoveries are of just the last few years.
Okay, well, I think the most fundamental point is to understand that we, you know, all of us in the universe swim in a sea of light, is the way I like to put it. There's a field out there of energy that's very much like the Force in Star Wars. It was very interesting, that movie. If you go back and look at it after seeing What the Bleep, you see a lot of the prescience of the movie makers there, too. There, a lot of scientists realized after the discovery of quantum physics that there was a thing called the vacuum or the zero-point field. And this is the energy in basically an empty space, in ground space, because what they realized that is that even if you reduce temperatures to even much colder than we've got today, to nearly absolute zero, subatomic particles don't stop moving, and they do a little energy dance with empty space. If you imagine all of us, it take us to our absolute nether particles, you know, the undercoat of our being, we're just basically energy in charge. And our subatomic particles are constantly treating energy with the energy of the field. And so it means that there is this unfathomable amount of energy lying there in empty space. If you were sitting a yard away from me, this energy is so dense and so extraordinarily that it would be enough to boil all the oceans of the world. So I think the most fundamental thing is that we have this energy dance, constant energy dance with the field. And it's very fundamental because we sort of realize that, you know, we are all one. We're all connected.
And that really, I think, is one of the things that we can key off on now to talk about the history of this. One of the ways I like to look at it is that in the vast sweep of the evolutionary history of the species, if we go back to our early indigenous ancestral roots, the DNA of which we still have in our contemporary bodies, we find that they had a profound understanding of the interconnectedness of all things. And in scholarly terms, it's sometimes called the participation mystique, or the mystical participation with nature. And they understood that they were an alive, wondrous, and sometimes dangerous universe, and that even rocks and stones had sentience or consciousness, in the sense that they were a part of creation, and all of creation was infused with what's sometimes called the great mystery, so that there could be communing with standing stones. There could be communing, of course, with plants and animals, as well as humans. And then when we got into what we might call the modern mind, some people date it back as long ago as 35,000 years, when people at that time began, humans, to move from Homo sapiens to Homo sapiens sapiens and put symbols on cave sides and so on. And certainly when we moved to agriculture and tried to control nature. And then most importantly, in the last 500 years or 300 years, starting, say, with Copernicus and then moving into the scientific revolution, we have an intensification of the modern mind, which literally disenchanted the universe and made it simply an object that was inert, without consciousness, existing only for us to try to figure out the rules that apply to it. And sometimes that's referred to as Newtonian, Cartesian worldview. And it really is at the heart of a quotation I'm about to read to lead into your next set of comments, Lynn. And this was made by the German philosopher Nietzsche, who realized at the end of the 19th century that the epical crisis of the modern mind would happen when it became conscious of its destruction of the metaphysical world or of the alive universe. And he said it in this aphorism, God is dead. And by that he meant that people had literally killed the mystery, a kind of Midas touch of the mind. Instead of everything turning to gold, everything turned to dead matter that we could try to organize according to the laws of physics and mathematics, but had no independent interactive consciousness of its own. So here's what Nietzsche said to predict what our crisis would be in the 20th century. Quote, What were we doing when we unchained the earth from its sun? Whither is it moving now? Whither are we moving? Away from all suns? Are we not plunging continually, backward, sideward, forward, in all directions? Is there still any up or down? Are we not straying as though through an infinite nothing? Do we not feel the breath of empty space? Has it not become colder? Is not night continually closing in on us? End of quote. And following that, we had the 20th century with its attempt to master the mystery of the universe with the mind, and the death by human hands of more millions of people in one century than all of prior human history. So with that backdrop, I think now, Lynn, if you could tell us how quantum physics began to shift that perception and open the door to a rediscovery and a reawakening of an alive universe infused with consciousness, in which we are, in fact, not all separate, but deeply interconnected and possessing the skills and the heart and the energy within ourselves, the life force, to actually bring about a new harmony, a new evolutionary era.
Okay, well, I think that's a very good summing up of Newtonian physics and the whole idea of, you know, ripping the heart out of the universe. Every single ancient culture has always believed in a life force. And it's only in these last hundreds of years that we haven't. And we've replaced it with this clockwork universe. But when about, 60 years ago, the quantum physicists came up with a couple of really strange things, and they realized they'd wandered into some very weird metaphysical territory. The first thing they observed was basically, in the thing we call the Copenhagen interpretation, that basic matter is indeterminate. I like to say that basic matter is unset jello. It's just this all possible things. When you take a subatomic particle like an electron, you can't ever know everything about it. You can know where it is, but not where it's going or what speed. You can know whether it's spinning up, but not where it is. And all that sort of indeterminate energy, it's sort of like having, somebody buy every condo on the block and live at it all at the same time. They're all possible situations, and it means basic matter is a potential. It's a possibility, a range of possibilities, and any one of those could be true. So that's one thing, the whole idea that we've got this unset jello of reality. And the other really important point is non-locality. And again, I like to call this separated at birth. And what it is this very strange telepathic signaling between subatomic particles, no matter how far they are moved apart. Once they've been in contact, they're always in contact, and they always influence each other. So it's like you have two twins that have been separated at birth, and one moves to Boulder, and the other one moves to Tokyo. And no matter the fact that they've never seen each other, if you follow them over time, you find that they both marry a woman called Jane. They both like the color blue. And even more importantly, when one is skiing in Boulder and breaks a leg, the other one breaks his leg too, even though he's sitting there in a Starbucks drinking a latte. So you have that constant connection all the time. And they're finding this in every part of the new physicists are looking and finding this all over the place. They're finding these non-local connections, this instant information in parts of empty space. They're finding it in our bodies. They're finding us in the light coming from stars that gets connected to things when the light comes to Earth. So it's all over the place. So these are two really important things. And they basically say nothing's solid or stable. Nothing's predictable. Everything exists as a state of infinite possibility. And there's only one thing that sort of collapses it down to any one state, and that's basically us. And that's what they called the observer effect. They realized that our consciousness, our act of noticing, creates reality at the moment of attention. I mean, they found this in a lot of experiments where as soon as you take a measurement, that electron starts to set. You know, you get this jello to set, basically. And so for me, this really says to me that reality isn't fixed, but fluid and hence open to influence. And there's plenty of evidence that we can talk about later that we are the influencers. We're the ordering systems.
And I think that's a really good phrase there. The universe is fluid and thus open to influence, because if we understand that at the fundamental level, instead of being a grouping of separate solid particles, the universe is really a dance of energy. And that because it's a dance of energy, these waveforms, that we are in fact all interconnected, and our DNA does contain the wisdom and the knowledge, we might say, of even our ancestral cultures, if it is in fact reawakened. And in my view, that seems to be what's happening with these recent developments in science. And so, once again, to give a little historical overview, we might say that the beginning of this unlocking of the rediscovery of an enchanted or alive or conscious universe began in the West when the scientific paradigm stumbled upon quantum physics. And at the beginning of that, Einstein himself was frustrated and irritated, saying that there were anomalies there that just couldn't possibly be true because they didn't square up with the kind of laws of physics that our understanding and view of the universe had become accustomed to. And so let us start with what happened after the discovery of quantum physics and when Einstein somewhat reluctantly then embraced it. And we've moved forward now for nearly 100 years. There were gaps in the early discoveries of quantum physics that have now been filled in by lesser-known scientists. People sometimes know the names of Schrödinger or Max Planck or Niels Bohr or others that were central to this revolution in science. But in terms of newer people like Robert John, Hal Puthoff, Fritz Albert Popp, Carl Pribram, and others you mentioned in your book, perhaps you could contrast this recent group, far less well-known, and what they have brought to the table in terms of their most recent discoveries.
Okay, well, I mean, these scientists, this is really 30 years ago, these kinds of frontier scientists you mentioned began to ask a couple of fundamental questions, like, you know, what hadn't been completed in quantum theory? And, you know, a real fundamental question, how come there are two kinds of physics? There's the physics of the large, you know, that's where all those Newtonian things have to happen with force, the law of thermodynamics, things fall apart, the law of entropy. But then there's another weird physics, the physics of the small, and how come they don't correlate? And they also ask things like, well, what's consciousness? And how far should we take this whole idea of the observer effect? And so the first one, and really one of the heroes of my book, is Hal Puthoff, who discovered this, or rediscovered the whole idea of the zero-point field, and said and believed that this was really fundamental. Physicists, since they've discovered it, they've known about it for many hundreds of years. They used to call it the ether, but scientists have subtracted it out because it messes up their equations. So I always like to say it's a bit like subtracting out God because it's so fundamental. But Hal realized that there was this vast inexhaustible quantum energy sea, and that we were packets of pulsating energy doing some sort of constant energy tango with this, and that we were probably resonating with our world. But he didn't have all the information about how we are quantum systems, because, you know, scientists still maintain that, no, these quantum effects only occur with dead things, not live things, and only when things are very cold and not a hot and messy thing like a human body.
Let's just hold on right there. An article quotes a scientist here from the CU Physics Department who says as follows, "I've never seen the movie What the Bleep, but I believe it's a mistake to try to use quantum physics to answer spiritual questions. The notion that a person could somehow perceive what is happening at the quantum level is nonsense. That kind of observation takes big, complicated machines and extremely low temperatures. To me, it is very hard to believe that something at room temperature, like the brain, should be exhibiting any kind of quantum phenomena which we can observe or experience." Close quote. Now there we have the voice of conventional science and authority right here from our university physics department. So what's wrong with this picture? Why should people not take our local authority at face value?
Okay. Well, because the frontier scientists that are out there doing the work don't agree with that anymore. Now, this is material for my latest book that I'm working on now, but I've been on the phone just a week ago with a number of scientists in special quantum work groups in Vienna, Israel, and Brussels, and they're all saying the same thing. They're finding quantum effects in the body. They're finding quantum effects from DNA. A Russian physicist has just come up with information demonstrating, and experimental evidence demonstrating, that there is frequency coming out of our DNA, and you can actually play this frequency and encourage plants to grow faster and do all sorts of strange things with it. There are scientists that are going to be at the conference that are going to be talking about the quantum effects they discover in tiny thing called microtubules in the brain. I mean, it's all over the place. We're finding it. And the big problem, the only reason that we find it in inert things and in very cold temperatures, is a technological limitation that we have. It's our problem. We can't measure it yet, but or at least we haven't been able to measure it yet. But some of the latest physicists are. They are discovering it. They're discovering it in University of Chicago, found quantum effects in atoms, and not just these subatomic particles. That means in the big world, too. And many people are saying non-locality is everywhere, and quantum effects are everywhere. And the other point, to say that this is not spiritual, the quantum fathers, the fathers of quantum physics, all realized they'd trespassed into a highly metaphysical territory. They were absolutely blown away by what they were discovering and the implications. And they all observed and looked at and studied ancient texts like the Upanishads and many of the Eastern texts and the ancient cultures, the ancient Aztecs and Native American cultures and all of that, who believed in something that was very akin to what they were discovering in quantum physics.
So let's pause now before we go back to actually some of these new discoveries, which I'm eager to get onto, but I think it's crucial for our audience that we visit now the sociology of science. And I'm going to start here with demystification of science and showing that it's just exactly like any other realm of authority, whether it's political or religious or any other kind of institutional setting in which the human beings that inhabit it, as Lord Acton said famously in the 19th century, the British historian thought to be, quote, the most civilized man of his era in Europe. He said, power tends to corrupt, and absolute power tends to corrupt absolutely, meaning that people do not walk their talk when it comes to something that threatens their egoic or territorial realm. We see this constantly with politicians and religious authorities who say one thing and do another. But sometimes it's surprising to our secular society, which has, in a sense, deified science, to find out that the scientists are just as susceptible to this as any other people in an institutional setting in society. And I'm going to quote a great scientist known to many people, Max Planck, who famously said, science progresses funeral to funeral. And what he meant by that was that even though science has the talky talk that we will respect and honor the results of any discovery or laboratory experiment or other experiment that follows rigorously the, quote, scientific method and double-blind experiments, in the real world, this does not happen all that often. And particularly, it does not happen every time there's a revolutionary discovery that goes against the tenets that people have built their entire publishing career on, their entire academic reputation on, and so on. And so we have these conflicts among scientists. But I think in the general culture, people think, well, gee, you know, science is different than religion or politics. You know, President Bush can say whatever he says about Social Security, and somebody else is going to say that he's actually mixed up about it or that he's deliberately dissimulating, and the same with religious authorities. But when it comes to science, geez, shouldn't there be some kind of ultimate way to verify what's right and what isn't? So then they tend to go with the credibility of the, quote, senior scientists, which we find now, if we look at the history of science, to be exactly the wrong place to put credibility. So when we come back to the comment of the local professor here at CU, who's a physics professor and described in our newspaper as an expert in string theory, this is the kind of typical journalism we see. They talk to some people who are going to be at this conference with the bleep, and they say one thing about what's emerging in quantum physics, and you're saying it in more detail here on this program. But then the author of the article will go to a local authority. They'll go to the university, a physics professor who's a, quote, expert in string theory. Apparently oblivious to all of the things that you're talking about that are happening all over the world. Now, I'd like you to address that and tell a couple of stories of how exactly this happens in the scientific community, how people who do discover these things get marginalized, get put off to the side. In the famous case of Semmelweis, who discovered, quote unquote, the existence of bacteria, he was so hounded when he told his fellow doctors in the 19th century to wash their hands before they operated because they might be actually transmitting bacteria into the vulnerable innards of their patients. He was so ridiculed for this statement that he ended up dying in an insane asylum. And we might say the Semmelweis effect. There are many, many examples of that, and perhaps you could give a couple of examples in terms of this quantum theory.
Sure. I mean, the problem with science is the real paradox. I mean, first of all, the job of the scientist is always to be an explorer and to find new ground and to stake out new territory. The problem is it also is supposed to provide a worldview, and every time you stake out new territory, you destroy the old worldview. And so that means that you're destroying a paradigm that many people have built their career on. And so, of course, they're going to fight against any kind of new experimental breakthroughs that are going to undermine the kind of work and their belief system. And, of course, science is, like many things, just a belief system. It's also, a really important point is it's also a process. I mean, we can never really know everything. We're just learning as we go along. And when we go along, we have to discard the old in favor of the new when we come up with discoveries. And I want to point out that all the people that I talk about in my book are credible scientists, again, from prestigious universities. But many of the people who decided to move into this new territory have absolutely been, you know, it was the stuff of treason, basically, what they were talking about. And so, for instance, Fritz Albert Popp, I mean, this is an absolute genius of a man who in playing around, he's a physicist in Germany, and in playing around with light as he did, I mean, he was looking at, the effect of radiology and things like that, he discovered that tiny bits of light were coming out of the human body, that we were, you know, that we're like candles, where we're just emanating these tiny bits of light. And he thought to himself, my goodness, I'm going to get the Nobel Prize for this. Well, he got thrown out of his university. For many years, he couldn't get a job. He was absolutely attacked from every possible way. And now, of course, they're now rediscovering that Popp was right, that not only is this light coming out of our bodies, not only is it coming in these frequencies from DNA, but that we're communicating with each other with this light, that it's all over the body, and it's got some resonating connection, so that he's had studies showing that when you put medicine on one part of the body, it increases the light coming out in that part and also everywhere else in your body. There's some sort of non-local connection going on with these frequencies. So Popp, then poor Jacques Benvenista, who has just died, who was a great hero of mine, he worked for INSERM, which was one of the highest government organizations of science. He was a very prestigious biologist who was noted for his work in allergies. But in the middle of doing that, almost by accident, he discovered that, that when you dilute water, when you dilute a substance, when it's almost just water, it still has an effect. So let's say you have a certain molecule, you take almost all the molecules out of it, and you just have plain water in a solution, and you apply that to other molecules that are supposed to have a chemical effect with the original molecule, you still get the chemical effect, even if there's not one molecule left from the water of the substance that you're using. And from that, he realized there must be some electromagnetic signaling going on between cells that is carried through water. Now, he was credited with proving homeopathy, which operates on this whole idea of taking all the substance out of something and just having its memory in water. And he published his material in Nature, but he got absolutely vilified. They sent back a fraud squad from this magazine and redid his tests and changed around a lot of the protocols. And lo and behold, they didn't get the same results and really destroyed his career like that. But Jacques was very, very proud and a very tenacious Frenchman, and he carried on working in a porta cabin with private funding, trying to work further in all of his, you know, discoveries. And he has brought forward a great deal of evidence that there is this kind of electromagnetic signaling going on, that you could just play the frequency, so to speak, of a particular molecule, and you're going to get the chemical reaction. All you need is the frequency, not the molecule itself. So those are two examples, but virtually all the physicists and the scientists in my book have been attacked in one way or another, or have to been very guarded about their incredible discoveries.
And again, we go back and revisit the quotation from Max Planck, where he said himself, as a famous scientist, that science advances funeral to funeral, meaning the old guys with the vested interest in the power positions of dictating to the rest of us lay people what our belief in reality should be. Exactly like the medieval church, mm-hmm. only they're the new church, they're the modern church, telling us with great authority and insistence the equivalent of the Earth is at the center of the universe, and people like Copernicus or Galileo that claim to the contrary, yes. were not only heretics, but if, like Bruno, you were passionate enough as an Italian to actually say this out loud, you got burned at the stake. Copernicus published his De Principia on the day he died, wisely, and Galileo kept his mouth shut and actually renounced his findings that Copernicus was right. Secretly, it is said by legend, whispering under his breath, pero il muove, you know, but it moves. But he actually kept quiet during his lifetime and was not forgiven his heresy by the Catholic Church until 367 years later, in November of 1992, long after we'd been on the moon and knew what revolved around what. The church didn't really reluctantly agree to it until 1992. And that finally brings up a comment by the philosopher Schopenhauer, who said famously that the truth emerges in three phases. First, it is ridiculed. Secondly, it is viciously and violently opposed, to the point of actually burning people at the stake or destroying their careers. And third, it is embraced then ultimately by the establishment as its own over the forgotten dead bodies of the pioneers that actually were bold enough to bring it forth into the public discourse in the first place.
Yes.
And so if we understand that, it gives us a whole different attitude when you read the paper and you hear someone who's described as a professor of physics and an expert in string theory trying to poo-poo all of this as quackery, clearly not addressing the issues and not even aware of the kind of research that's being done that you have unearthed in your book as an independent, quote, investigative journalist. It takes an investigative journalist, for heaven's sakes, to actually unearth what's happening out there, because the scientific community is not bringing it forward in its conventional journals.
Yes. And remember too, these guys are out there on the frontier. I mean, they're making discoveries they don't even understand. You know, they'll could just come up with it and say, whoa, that's interesting, or that's unusual, and they don't really necessarily put it together with the other people. Everybody's got their own little patch, and I always say it's like each one has discovered a bucket of Earth, but no one wants to declare it a continent, because they each have their own little separate section, and it's scientists hate to speculate, and they also hate to tie it in with other things, and so I found that one of my real jobs was to put it together, but I did go back to them constantly to say, is this right? Do you think this could be? And I think they were surprised to move, as I say, move outside of it. But I had them all read sections of the book and three of the scientists read the whole thing to make sure that I was on the right track.
In other words, anytime you talked about one of the scientists that had discovered something here on the edges, you basically had him read it or her to verify it was accurate. And then you had people like Edgar Mitchell, the astronaut, read the whole book and the founder of the Institute of Noetic Sciences to verify the science. And I think that's a very important thing for us to emphasize.
What does this really mean? You know, what does it really mean to be completely connected? Because it means that you've really got to rethink all of your notions of everything from time, because some of the things are some very strange ideas about time going forward and backward, and being demonstrated by evidence that, you know, almost like you can go back and fix things, that time is much more circular rather than an arrow going forward, that it means a whole other thing. Because, you know, one of the big central problems we have in our lives is the idea of separateness. You know, mine is bigger than yours. I've got to win. I've got to compete. I've got to do better. I'm alone. I don't have enough. All those sorts of ideas. Now, they're completely contrary. That's a separatist view. It's very contrary to the view that we're trying to, the worldview we're bringing forward of connectedness. So it's looking at that whole view and starting to look at how that translates into the workplace, how it translates into things with your children. What do you teach your kids if you don't want to teach them to compete? You know, how do you cope with people you don't like? You know, you don't like yourself then if we're all connected. It's things like that. We're going to look at a lot of other cultures and how they do it, cultures that are based much more on holism and what they do and how they look at time and how they teach people and what they do as a group and how do they work as a community. So it's going to be looking at all of that. And it's also based on, I should say, Duncan, we've been doing this ever since I published my book. I've had thousands of letters from people saying, well, how do I live the field? You know, this is great, but how do I incorporate this into my life? And so we've organized it as a course. We have a four-year, it's almost like a newsletter, but we call it a course, and it's a written course that has explored much of this for several years now. So that's one of the things we do, and I'm going to just tell people about our website, which is www.livingthefield.com, which has some information, and it has also an e-news that is generating more information back and forth, because we're creating groups all around. We're creating basically small groups that are working and doing this sort of thing together and working on developing and expanding human potential, because many of the things that are implied in quantum physics indicate that we're only a glimmer of what we really can be. Many of the things in quantum physics, as many of my scientists mention, really provides a framework for all of those so-called paranormal experiences that are marginalized in science and said to not really exist, like ESP, like distant healing, and all those sorts of things. So we start working on how to develop these. How do you develop, you know, how do you heal? We do healing in it, and we do all kinds of things like that. But we're creating these small groups because, as we all know, small groups are where magic happens. And we are even starting to have information where people can contact each other via our website. So there's hopefully this, what we call Living the Field community, that is starting to grow up in people really looking and reevaluating their lives.
That's very well said. I think small groups are where magic happens, because it is what is now emerging and being identified and named as the field of collective intelligence, getting more and more visibility, we might say, in our culture. The magazine What is Enlightenment had an entire issue dedicated to collective intelligence, and that's available in reprint. And it's very interesting, because they said for collective intelligence to draw down the mystery, for us to tap into our collective intelligence rather than just our individual limited storehouse of knowledge and individual limited capacities, there need to be certain conditions present. And one of them is transparency, where everyone in the group can see the whole and its discrete parts at the same time. And this happens, of course, most effectively in small groups. It can happen increasingly, we see in technology, with things like Lexis or open systems, where people can contribute actually from a very wide geographic base to the ongoing creation of a piece of technology, because it is transparent. But normally, when we're doing mouth-to-ear communication, in the physical world, the small groups is where you can actually feel and experience that energy field and connect with it directly. And I'll give an example here that's somewhat poetic. Coleman Barks, the famous American translator of Rumi, the 13th century Persian poet who's now become the most published poet in America through Coleman's wonderful translations, was once asked by a journalist whether he really understood Rumi, because Rumi was the, you know, poetic equivalent of some of these scientists. He was a mystic, and they said his meaning is not always apparent on the surface. So do you really understand him? And Coleman said, well, I travel around the country about 100 times a year reading Rumi's poetry. And he said, I find that when I'm in the presence of an audience that's done a lot of its own deep work, then I understand Rumi. But it's an elusive understanding, and it depends on who I'm with. In other words, he acknowledged the field effect experientially. And I can say from my experience here in broadcasting that because I'm aware of the fact that the audience for this program is full of people whose depth of experience and depth of understanding and deep listening is such that the kind of conversation you and I are having here on the public airways would not even be evoked from us if there weren't that kind of virtual understanding that out there, there's a third party in this dialogue, the audience of deep listeners that is causing the level of this discussion to come forward at the level it is. If we thought that everybody out there thought this was complete hokum and was willing to dismiss it just because it wasn't something that they were familiar with, we may not even have this conversation at all.
Exactly.
So the field is everywhere, and it's very interesting, and you can experience it, and that to me is the key. It's not about scientific concept or religious concept or political concept. It's about learning how to unlock the wisdom that we already have in our DNA. And I think from this point of view, Lynn, why don't you address this notion of where the intelligence is coming from? And I'll just put it by quoting from your book. You say each of these pioneering scientists had chanced upon an anomaly in this conventional thinking and had the courage and the independence to pursue that line of inquiry. And to me, what it means is that they stumbled across something in the field, in the collective mystery, that they just happened to draw down frequently by accident, when they weren't trying, when they weren't paying attention, when they were on vacation. Famous stories of scientists having the aha in the bathtub or stepping off a bus when they relaxed the intense effort that they had of trying to figure something out, and all of a sudden it dropped in almost by grace.
Yes. Well, first of all, I mean, a lot of these scientists, believe it or not, believe that, you know, memories don't exist inside our heads, but are out there in the field. And I mean, these are prestigious scientists believing this now, and believe that there is this collective information, because frequencies carry information. I mean, and they carry unlimited information. And there's now increasing evidence that there is almost a, you know, that the field, the zero point field is a memory bank, basically. And that we draw this information down, we access it. And of course, one of the clearest examples of that is out of body experiences during near death experiences. That's the one thing they cannot explain. They can explain everything else. But, you know, we're talking about a body, a computer unplugged, basically, with somebody in a near-death experience. And yet, they experience themselves over and over as being above their own bodies and see themselves down and have information, and scientists have verified this, that they could not have known unless they had seen this. Information with accident victims, knowing where their false teeth were, for instance, you know, where that they got put on a crash cart, things like that. And so, so it's information like that that makes one, and there's more and more information I put in my book, demonstrating that there is this sort of collective information bank that we are tapping and accessing. And if there are non-local connections between everything in this field, as has been demonstrated by a number of scientists, then what we have to relearn, as many of the ancient cultures knew, was how to listen. We have to relearn how to listen. We have to relearn how to resonate with this and pick up the information. That's some of the things that we're working on in these small groups, is things like remote viewing, is developing and acknowledging your intuitive and your ESP abilities, is picking up more and more collective information, working for using collective intention as a group. But it's the sort of thing, as I say, that we're all out there, we're all Christopher Columbus without a compass, and we're all having to relearn this or explore this together.
I think that's beautifully put, and I'm going to give three examples here of how that exists in our time. I traveled to India in 1997, 1998, and 2001, and in 1998, I was literally called by thought forms to a yogi who existed far up in the Himalayas. I was not certainly looking for this kind of encounter. If I were to tell the story in detail, you'd see what a chance encounter it appeared to be, but it was clear afterwards that he had kind of sent out a messenger to find me on the road there at 10,000 feet in the Himalayas near a town that I was staying in. And I went to this little tiny ashram. He'd been living in the jungle for literally decades and had just created this little outpost there. Invisible. You would have to know where it was to even find it. And when I was talking to him there, he basically conversed very fluently with me in English. The local lore and individual people I talked to, because I went back in 2001, verified that he was at least 130 years old. Some thought more than 150 years old, because people that were 85 remembered him from their youth. And basically, what I found out and observed was that he was able to converse with people that came to see him in any number of languages, none of which he had ever learned. So when he saw a Swedish person, if he wanted to communicate with them, he talked to her in Swedish.
Wow.
If he met a German person, he talked in German, and it was explained to me by someone that had known him for some time that although he had no formal education, he drew on the universal energy bank of language.
Mm-hmm.
This is what was explained to me. Now, what we're finding here is that there's, quote, scientific verification for this otherwise anomalous experience. But I had this experience myself. I personally witnessed it. Secondly, there is a new book by Irvin Laszlo just out called Science in the Akashic Field. And we're familiar with these talks of the Akashic Records and so on. And what he's basically saying is the same thing that is in your book, that there is information in the field that is known sometimes as the Akashic Record, which holds the record of all that ever happened in life on Earth and in the cosmos. Now, this is something where Laszlo's pioneering this, and he has scientific methodology that is basically extrapolating, as you might put it, Lynn, from these basic discoveries that are now being made. And the third thing we might adduce here is that Tibetans talk about something called terma, T-E-R-M-A. It's their term for hidden knowledge, which could be hidden in material form or in the intangible realms to precipitate out at the time it's really needed in the world. One example of this known to many of us are the Nag Hammadi Gospels, which were discovered in clay tablets and clay pots in 1947 in Egypt and had a more, you might say, mystical or a deeper view of the teachings of Christ than had been reported in previous Gospels.
Mm-hmm.
And the corollary is that there are also teachings, you might say, that are in the field that precipitate out without a material intermediary like the clay tablets. Gilgamesh, for instance, the great hero story in our Western culture, was lost for 3,000 years until rediscovered in 11 clay tablets in the middle of the 19th century, and has only been now translated as of last fall by Stephen Mitchell into an English translation that our contemporary mind can really relate to.
Mm-hmm.
So these kinds of things happen in the world. And instead of just shrugging our shoulders and say, well, it's an anomaly and it doesn't fit our scientific perspective, so I'll either think it's irrelevant or quackery, you have made, I think, a great contribution here by connecting all of these dots in the field together and also creating this methodology through your seminar and through your website that people can actually access these kinds of things for themselves, and in the best scientific tradition, don't take it on faith.
Yes, and I think thank you. I think that, well, listen, we're all aware, it's evident all over the place that we're undergoing a big paradigm shift. And as I say, we all have to learn together, how do we act and relate in the world? And it's certainly probably pretty evident to all of us that what we've been doing up to now in modern history isn't working very well. And so we need to start re-looking at this based on the science that we have, and that is to understand it as this process of discovery and to remain open and to remain open in learning how to live. We're all toddlers learning how to walk again.
Well, I think it's beautiful because in your book, you also say the coming scientific revolution has heralded the end of dualism in every sense, and it has made of us all potential Christopher Columbuses in the scientific sense or in the sense of discovery. That when Columbus came back and said what he'd found, nobody believed him when he returned to tell the tale. And many people felt that this was just fantasy, and they continued to believe in the notion that the Earth was flat. And of course, that will always be the case. People will only be willing to let go of their view of the world incrementally unless they sort of catch fire with this spirit of inquiry and can see it grounded in their own experience. And I think the end of dualism between so-called science and these other mysterious experiences, such as the one with the yogi I describe in India, when they come together and we see, well, yes, this isn't just some one-off kind of oddball experience, but it's something that actually pervades the nature of reality.
We all have these feelings and we've all had these experiences. I mean, we get thousands of letters from people out there explaining their experiences and writing to us. And it's by acknowledging that and saying, well, there's now a scientific evidence for this, we can incorporate them in our lives. And I think one of the other great things about this is, for me, it's been a really positive view because, you know, science gives us a very reductive view of the world, a very negative thing, like we're some sort of genetic mistake and we're a lonely person on a lonely planet in a lonely universe.
Just as Nietzsche said, you know, can you not feel the cold?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And here now we've got this positive thing that we're all connected. I mean, my little daughter, Caitlin, when she was 5, used to always kind of, I mean, she really likes being with other people. And she used to sort of do her little prayers and say, I'm not alone, I'm not alone. And I dedicated the field to her because I said to her, you never were alone, but only always part of a greater whole.
Well, you know, our listeners may be familiar with the late Terence McKenna, who made many pioneering adventures to South America and elsewhere, and a pioneering adventurer of consciousness who spent many years of his life and the last years of his life studying world history and graphing on a computer the changes in consciousness and when they occurred and what they were due to. And one of the things he was fond of saying was that what the shamans know, again, going back to our deep DNA knowledge that goes back literally tens of thousands and more years, what the shamans know is that we are all held in the warm embrace of a caring intelligence.
That's a lovely way of putting it.
Yeah. And knowing that, we can go forward without the kind of fear and anxiety that the dualism and the reductiveness of the modern world creates and results in the kinds of policies, political, economic, and social, that we see not only in our own societies, but around the world. And this holds a key to a certain kind of optimism. And I love it that you dedicated this to your child, who at some point, like Wordsworth says, we come in trailing clouds of glory, and then, getting and spending, we lay waste our powers. So here's your daughter, young enough to know something's a bit wrong as she starts to move into the, quote, age of reason, and her innate knowingness of being held in the warm embrace of a caring intelligence, she begins to sense not everybody is getting that, and what's wrong here, and she starts to do the equivalent of a mantra to remind herself that this deeper truth is there and to evoke it. And fortunately, having a mother like you, you can come in from the adult world, as is not often the case, and confirm this.
Mm. Well, I think our new generation of children are going to understand this, that there is much more connectedness here and that we can access this and we can honor all those intuitive powers that we have, that we can, in a sense, you know, that our intention is a powerful thing, and that we can work together in other ways, and that we don't have to create a society of mine is bigger than yours, that we can create a completely different world. And the power is in our hands. The power of our lives is in our hands. And I think that is, you know, it's an empowering message, and it certainly was a very empowering thing for me, coming from nothing but medical mishap, which is all I was hearing about in my other, with my other hat on. And it was lovely to see that there is this, you know, this positive way forward. The scientists in my book, The Field, are all credible scientists. They've been doing huge amounts of work. One of them has been work on the ability of human intention to affect machines. Now, this is at Princeton University. He's done hundreds and thousands of studies, and they have demonstrated that human beings have the power, their intention will change electronic machines. And there have been studies like that all over the world using looking at human intention for healing, for changing and affecting other living systems, even one thing I call let us pray, you know, even for affecting plants and making plants grow better. And these are with good scientific studies. So people need to open their mind to something new and reacquaint themselves with scientific discovery, because that's really what's happening now.
Well, Lynn, I couldn't agree more, and we've come suddenly to the end of our time together, and I just want to say that, as you say in your book, it is also important to stress that none of this, as you put it, is my discovery. I am not a scientist. I am only the reporter and occasionally the interpreter. But in fact, that's true for all of us, including the scientists. None of us are anything other than the reporter and occasionally the interpreter of experience we're graced with. And for having graced us with your labor and the fruit of your labor, I want to thank you very much, Lynn. It's been such a great pleasure talking
with
you.
Wonderful. It's been great to talk with you, Duncan.
I'm your host, Duncan Campbell, inviting you to be with us next week for Living Dialogues. And once you have entered your free subscription to the Living Dialogues podcast here on Personal Life Media, future Living Dialogues will automatically be downloaded to your computer on a weekly basis. If you'd like to obtain a full transcript of this dialogue or additional dialogues I've done with the many other transformational thinkers listed on my website, livingdialogues.com, that's living, DIALOGUES.com. You can contact me at Duncan@personallifemedia.com. Thanks again for your deep listening. All the very best. And stay tuned now after the music for some very interesting opportunities available to you as a listener to Living Dialogues.
Find more great shows like this on PersonalLifeMedia.com.